Is it cold?
No, I've committed the highest breach of etiquette you can do in the yurt. I forgot to record. Now, we are going to be beginning tonight. I so want to break tradition and go with the sonorous tones of Charles de Gaulle, speaking to his nation in very, you know, romantic language about Nazis. But since we do have a shtick to keep to, I'm going to go with 1942. I don't think this is the 11th of October or the 10th of November. I don't think that's right. I think El Alamein was sometime in March. Because this is Winston Churchill with El Alamein, the end of the beginning.
We have not so far this war taken as many German prisoners as they have taken British. But these German prisoners will no doubt come in droves at the end, just as they did last time. I have never promised anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat. Now, however, we have a new experience. We have victory. A remarkable and definite victory. A bright gleam has caught the helmets of our soldiers and warmed and cheered all our hearts. The late Monsieur Venizelos observed that in all our wars, England, he ought to have said Britain, of course, England always wins one battle, the last. We seem to have begun rather earlier this time. General Alexander. With his brilliant comrade and lieutenant, General Montgomery, has gained a glorious and decisive victory in what I think should be called the Battle of Egypt. Rommel's army has been defeated. It has been routed. It has been very largely destroyed as a fighting force. Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Henceforward, Hitler's Nazis will be equally well armed, and perhaps even better armed troops. Henceforward, they will have to face, in many theaters, that superiority in the air, which they have so often used without mercy against others, and of which they boasted all around the world. They were to be the masters in which they intended to use as the instrument for convincing all other peoples that all resistance to them was hopeless. When I read, my lords and gentlemen, of the coastal road crammed with the flying German vehicles under the blasting attacks of the Royal Air Force, I could not but remember those roads of France and Flanders, crowded not with fighting men, but with the helpless refugees, women and children, fleeing with their pitiful barrows and household goods, on whom such merciless cruelty was wreaked. I have, my Lord Mayor, I trust, a humane disposition, but I must say I could not help feeling that what was happening, however grievous, was only justice grimly reclaiming her rights.
The That was Winston Churchill, Al Alamein, The End of the Beginning. I have some connections to that speech, as I've been replaying Call of Duty 2. Possibly the best World War II FPS ever made, I stand by that opinion. In this game, there is a British campaign, something that every World War II game every World War II game needs. Few have. Call of Duty 2 is one of the ones that does have, and the British campaign is sublime. You shoot Nazis in the desert. Good times. Now, I had to concede tradition there, as I mentioned before, and so we started with Churchill. But now, Charles de Gaulle.
Le gouvernement français, après avoir demandé l'armistice, connaît maintenant les conditions dictées par l'ennemi. Il résulte de ces conditions que les forces françaises de terre, de mer et de l'air seraient entièrement démobilisées, que nos armes seraient livrées, que le territoire français serait totalement occupé et que le gouvernement français tomberait sous la dépendance de l'Allemagne et de l'Italie. On peut donc dire que cet armistice serait non seulement une capitulation, mais encore un asservissement. Or, beaucoup de Français n'acceptent pas la capitulation ni la servitude pour des raisons qui s'appellent l'honneur, le bon sens, l'intérêt supérieur de la patrie. Je dis l'honneur, car la France s'est engagée à ne déposer les armes que d'accord avec ses alliés. Tant que ses alliés continuent la guerre, son gouvernement n'a pas le droit de se rendre à l'ennemi. Le gouvernement polonais, le gouvernement norvégien, le gouvernement hollandais, le gouvernement belge, le gouvernement luxembourgeois, quoique chassés de leur territoire, ont compris ainsi leur devoir. Je dis le bon sens, car il est absurde de considérer la lutte comme perdue. Oui, nous avons subi une grande défaite, un système militaire mauvais, les fautes commises dans la conduite des opérations, l'esprit d'abandon du gouvernement pendant ces derniers combats nous ont fait perdre la bataille de France. Mais il nous reste un vaste empire, une flotte intacte, beaucoup d'or. Il nous reste des alliés dont les ressources sont immenses et qui dominent les mers. Il nous reste les gigantesques possibilités de l'industrie américaine, les mêmes conditions de la guerre qui nous ont fait battre par 5000 avions et 6000 chars peuvent nous donner demain la victoire par 20 000 chars et 20 000 avions. Je dis l'intérêt supérieur de la patrie, car cette guerre n'est pas une guerre franco-allemande qu'une bataille puisse décider. Cette guerre est une guerre mondiale. Nul ne peut prévoir si les peuples qui sont neutres aujourd'hui le resteront demain. Même les alliés de l'Allemagne resteront-ils toujours ses alliés? Si les forces de la liberté triomphent finalement de celles de la servitude, quel serait le destin d'une France qui se serait soumise à l'ennemi? L'honneur, le bon sens, l'intérêt supérieur de la patrie commande à tous les Français libres de continuer le combat là où ils seront et comme ils pourront. Il est par conséquent nécessaire de grouper partout où cela se peut une force française aussi grande que possible. Tout ce qui peut être réuni en fait d'éléments militaires français et de capacités françaises de production d'armement doit être organisé partout où il y en a. Moi, général de Gaulle, j'entreprends ici, en Angleterre, cette tâche nationale. J'invite tous les militaires français des armées de terre, de mer et de l'air. J'invite les ingénieurs et les ouvriers français spécialistes de l'armement qui se trouvent en territoire britannique ou qui pourraient y parvenir à se réunir à moi. J'invite les chefs, les soldats, les marins, les aviateurs, les forces françaises de terre, de mer, de l'air, où qu'ils se trouvent actuellement, à se mettre en rapport avec moi. J'invite tous les Français qui veulent rester libres à m'écouter et à me suivre. Vive la France, libre dans l'honneur et dans l'indépendance.
Well, folks, true to the character of our subject matter, we were just invaded by a portion of sea cabbage. Yeah, Charles de Gaulle, even when he's dead in the ground, 40, 50 years maybe 30, 35-ish, he's still getting his turf trod on by other people. Yeah, very sad. Oh, I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't watching the time. And I have to try and find what I want to play for you next. You know what? I think it's going to be Ronald Reagan. I wanted Nikita Khrushchev. I wanted his 1956 speech. I thought that would have been absolutely lovely to play. Unfortunately, that speech was not recorded. The text was not made available to the general public until 1989. The only audio of it we have available is a 3-hour reading by some person I'm not very interested in English. I want a Russian speech by a Russian man. Have to settle for Reagan. Here we are. Tear down this wall.
And now the Soviets themselves may, in a limited way, be coming to understand the importance of freedom. We hear much from Moscow about a new policy of reform and openness. Some political prisoners have been released. Certain foreign news broadcasts are no longer being jammed. Some economic enterprises have been permitted to operate with greater freedom from state control. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state, or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. I understand the fear of war and the pain of division that afflict this continent. And I pledge to you my country's efforts to help overcome these burdens. To be sure, we in the West must resist Soviet expansion. So we must maintain defenses of unassailable strength. Yet we seek peace, so we must strive to reduce arms on both sides. Beginning 10 years ago, the Soviets challenged the Western alliance with a grave new threat. Hundreds of new and more deadly SS-20 nuclear missiles, capable of striking every capital in Europe. The Western Alliance responded by committing itself to a counter-deployment. Unless the Soviets agreed to negotiate a better solution, namely the elimination of such weapons on both sides, for many months, the Soviets refused to bargain in earnestness. As the alliance in turn prepared to go forward with its counter-deployment, there were difficult days, days of protests, like those during my 1982 visit to this city. And the Soviets later walked away from the table. But through it all, the alliance held firm. And I invite those who protested then, I invite those who protest today, to mark this fact, because we remain strong, the Soviets came back to the table.
That was Ronald Reagan speaking in 1989. Tear down this wall, and yep, so he did. That's what happened. I don't know if you saw it. The end of this video clip, Reagan climbs off that podium, goes to the wall, and begins to tear it down with his bare hands. Not many people know this. Ronald Reagan was... he had the strength of 1,000 men. There's no other way to put it. Now, I think the next selection we have is a rather lengthy piece. It is a piece by... oh, terrible, terrible moment. So embarrassing, I forgot Nelson Mandela's first name, which happens to be Nelson. This is Nelson Mandela. I believe he's speaking just after going to prison or just before going to prison. I really doubt that there is a microphone in prison with him. This is either just before or just after, and I'm going to go with just before. That is what I feel on this. Enjoy.
Our fight is against real and not imaginary hardship. Or to use the language of the state prosecutor, so-called hardships. Basically, my lord, we fight against two features which are the hallmarks of African life in South Africa and which are entrenched by legislation which we seek to have repealed. These features are poverty and lack of human dignity. And we do not need communists richest country in Africa. And could be one of the richest countries in the world. But it is a land of extremes and remarkable contrasts. And remarkably white. Enjoy what may well be the highest standard of living in the world, whilst Africans live in poverty and misery. 40% of the Africans live in hopelessly overcrowded and in some cases drought-stricken reserves where soil erosion and the overworking of the soil make it impossible for them to live properly off the land. 30% are laborers, labor tenants, and squatters on white farms, and work and live under conditions similar to those of the serfs of the Middle Ages. The other 30% live in towns where they have developed economic and social habits which bring them closer in many respects to white standard. Yet most Africans, even in this group, are impoverished by low incomes and the high cost of living. The highest paid and the most prosperous section of urban African life is in Johannesburg. Yet their actual position is desperate. The latest figures were given on the 25th of March, 1964, by Mr. Carr, manager of the Johannesburg Non-European Affairs Department. The poverty datum line for the average African family in Johannesburg, according to Mr. Carr's department, is 42 rand, 84 cents a month. He showed that the average monthly wage is 32 rand, 24 cents, and that 46% of all African families in Johannesburg do not earn enough to keep them going. Poverty goes hand in hand with malnutrition and disease. The incidence of malnutrition and deficient diseases is very high amongst Africans. Tuberculosis, pellagra, kwashiorkor, gastroenteritis, and scurvy bring death and destruction of health. The incidence of infant mortality is one of the highest in the world. According to the Medical Officer of Health for Pretoria, it is estimated that tuberculosis kills 40 people a day, almost all Africans. And in 1961, there were 58,491 new cases reported. These diseases, my lord, not only destroy the vital organs of the body, but they result in retarded mental conditions and lack of initiative and reduce powers of concentration. The secondary results of such conditions affect the whole community and the standard of work performed by Africans. The complaint of Africans, however, is not only that they are poor, a and white are rich. But that the laws which are made by the white are designed to preserve the situation. Poverty goes hand in hand with malnutrition and disease. The incidence of malnutrition and deficient diseases is very high amongst Africans. Tuberculosis, pellagra, kwashiorkor, gastroenteritis, and scurvy bring death and destruction of health. The incidence of infant mortality is one of the highest in the world. According to the Medical Officer of Health for Pretoria, it is estimated that tuberculosis kills 40 people a day, almost all Africans. And in 1961, there were 58,491 new cases reported. These diseases, my lord, not only destroy the vital organs of the body, but they result in retarded mental conditions and lack of initiative and reduced powers of concentration. The secondary results of such conditions affect the whole community and the standard of work performed by Africans. The complaint of Africans, however, is not only that they are poor and white are rich, but that the laws which are made by the white are designed to preserve the situation. There are two ways to break out of poverty. The first is by formal education. And the second is by the worker acquiring a greater skill at his work and thus higher wages. As far as Africans are concerned, both these avenues of advancement are deliberately curtailed by legislation. I ask the court to remember that the present government has always sought to humble Africans in their search for education. One of their early acts after coming into power was to stop subsidies for African school feeding. Many African children who attended schools depended on this supplement to their diet. This was a cruel act. There is compulsory education for all white children, etc. no cost to their parents, be they rich or poor. Similar facilities are not provided for the African children, though there are some who receive such assistance. African children, however, generally have to pay more for their schooling than whites. According to figures quoted by the South African Institute of Race Relations in its 1963 journal, approximately 40% of African children in the age group between 7 and 14 do not attend school. For those who do attend school, the standards are vastly different from those afforded to white children. In 1960-61, the per capita government spending for African students at state-aided schools was estimated at 12 rands, 46 cents. In the same years, the per capita spending on white children in the Cape Province, which are the only figures available to me, was 144 rands, 57 cents. Although there are no figures available to me, it can be stated without doubt that the white children on whom 144 rand, 57 cents a head was being spent, all came from wealthier homes than African children, on whom 12 rand, 46 cents per head was being spent. Equality of education is also different. According to the Bantu Education Journal, only 5,660 African children in the whole of South Africa passed their junior certificate in 1962. And in that year, only 362 passed matric. This is presumably consistent with the policy of Bantu education about which the present Prime Minister said during the debate on the Bantu Education Bill in 1953, when he was Minister of Native Affairs, I quote, "When I have control of native education, I will reform it so that natives will be taught from childhood to realize that equality with Europeans is not for them. People who believe in equality are not desirable teachers for natives. When my department controls native education, it will know for what class of higher education a native is fitted, and whether he will have a chance in life to use his knowledge." Unquote. The other main obstacle to the economic advancement of the African people is the industrial collapse, under which all better jobs of industry are reserved for whites only. Moreover, Africans in the unskilled and semi-skilled occupations which are open to them are not allowed to form trade unions, which have recognition under the Industrial Conciliation Act. This means that strikes of African workers are illegal and that they are denied the right of collective bargaining, which is permitted to the better paid white workers. The discrimination in the policy of successive South African governments toward African workers is demonstrated by the so-called civilized labor policy, under which sheltered, unskilled government jobs are found for those white workers who cannot make the grade in industry at wages which far exceeded the end of the average African employee in industry. The government often answers its critics by saying that Africans in South Africa are economically better off than the inhabitants of the other countries in Africa. I do not know whether this statement is true, and doubt whether any comparison can be made without having regard to the cost of living index in such countries. But even if it is true, as far as African people are concerned, it is irrelevant. Our complaint is not that we are poor by comparison with people in other countries, but that we are poor by comparison with white people in our own country. And that we are prevented by legislation from altering this imbalance. The lack of human dignity experienced by Africans is the direct result of the policy of white supremacy. White supremacy implies black inferiority. Legislation designed to preserve white supremacy entrenches this notion. Menial tasks in South Africa are invariably performed by Africans. When anything has to be carried or cleaned, the white man will look around for an African to do it for him, whether the African is employed by him or not. Because of this sort of attitude, whites tend to regard Africans as a separate breed. They do not look upon them as people with families of their own. They do not realize that we have emotions, that we fall in love, that we want to be with our wives and children, like white people want to be with theirs, that we want to earn money, enough money, to support our families properly, to feed and clothe them, and send them to school. And what house boy or garden boy or laborer can ever hope to do this? Pass laws which to the Africans are among the most hated bits of legislation in South Africa, render any African liable to police surveillance at any time. I doubt whether there is a single African male in South Africa who has not at some stage had a brush with the police over his boss. Hundreds and thousands of Africans are wander about the streets of the township. Because they have no schools to go to, or no money to enable them to go to school, or no parents at home to see that they go to school. Because both parents, if there be two, have to work to keep the family alive. This leads to a breakdown in moral standards, to an alarming rise in illegitimacy, and to growing violence, which erupts not only politically, but everywhere. Life in the township is dangerous. There is not a day that goes by without some bonded body being scared or assaulted. And violence is carried out of the townships into the white living areas. People are afraid to walk alone in the streets after dark. House breakings and robberies are increasing, despite the fact that the death sentence can now be imposed for such offenses. Death sentences cannot cure the festering soul. The only cure is to alter the conditions under which Africans are forced to live and to meet their legitimate grievances. Africans want to be paid a living wage. Africans want to perform work which they are capable of doing, and not work which the government declares them to be capable of. We want to be allowed to live where we obtain work, and not be endorsed out of an area because we were not born there. We want to be allowed and not to be obliged to live in rented houses which we can never call our own. We want to be part of the general population and not confined to living in our ghettos. African men want to have their wives and children to live with them where they work, and not to be forced into an unnatural existence in men's hostels. Our women want to be with their men folk and not to be left permanently widowed in the reserve. We want to be allowed out after 11 o'clock at night and not to be confined our rooms like little children. We want to be allowed to travel in our own country and to seek work where we want to, where we want to, and not where the Labour Bureau tells us to. We want a just share in the whole of South Africa. We want security and a stake in society. Above all, my Lord, we want equal political rights. Because without them, our disabilities will be permanent. I know this sounds revolutionary to the whites in this country, because the majority of voters will be Africans. This makes the white man fear democracy. But this fear cannot be allowed to stand in the way of the only solution which will guarantee racial harmony and freedom for all. It is not true that the enfranchisement of all will result in racial domination. Political division based on caste is entirely artificial. And when it disappears, so will the domination of one color group by another. The ANC has spent half a century fighting against racialism. When it triumphs, as it certainly must, it will not change that policy. This, then, is what the ANC is fighting. our struggle. He's a truly national. It is a struggle of the African people, inspired by our own suffering and our own experience. It is a struggle for the right to live. During my lifetime, I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Oh dear. Once again, we have invasions occurring into our history. This time, I'm afraid, it was Modest Mouse encouraging Nelson Mandela to march into the sea. No, I'm afraid not. That's General Sherman, and Nelson Mandela had a long walk to freedom. Didn't have a short stroll to the seashore. Long walk to freedom, that's what he did. I checked my facts, and that speech was given during his trial in 1964. He was on trial for attempting to sabotage facilities in the town of, I can't remember, in the northwest of the country. That much I do remember. I believe it was a shipyard. I could be mistaken. He was attempting to dismantle the apartheid structure. That's what you call it. He had a statement here. If I can find this statement, I will read it for you. And this is the line from which the speech gets its name. Now, here we are. A few things. First of all, he spoke for 5 hours. That's impressive. It is. That's all I'm going to say on that. Now, he said, "I do not deny that I planned sabotage. I did not do this in a spirit of recklessness. I planned it as a result of calm and sober assessment. Now, we had either to accept inferiority or fight against it by violence. We chose the latter." These were some of his responses to his prosecutors. Last, I promise you this line. This is the line that is the title line. Speaking about the end of white domination, he says, "It is an idea I hope to live and see realized, but it is an idea for which I am prepared to die." Noble words. Nelson Mandela. Now, our closing segment for tonight will be, you guessed it, Winston Churchill. Let's see what we have. We have... if only we could conduct an audience poll. We've got two good segments tonight. of either his first speech as Prime Minister in 1940 or speaking about the Atlantic Charter in 1941.
First speech.
We have a vote. First speech. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you all tonight. Maybe three of you. If so, I'm excited. Now, a pleasant evening, and, well, yeah, I'm sure you can figure the rest out. You don't need to tell me how your evening is. Listen to the speech. Good night.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track. Behind them, there are now appearing infantry in lorries, and behind them again, the large masses are moving forward. The regroupment of the French army to make head against and also to strike at this intruding wedge has been proceeding for several days, largely assisted by the magnificent efforts of the Royal Air Force. We must not allow ourselves to be intimidated by the presence of these armored vehicles in unexpected places behind our lines. If they are behind our front, the French are also, at many points, fighting actively behind theirs. Both sides are therefore in an extremely dangerous position. And if the French army and our own army are well handled, as I believe they will be, if the French retain that genius for recovery and counterattack for which they have so long been famous, and if the British army shows the dogged endurance and solid fighting power of which there have been so many examples in the past, then a sudden transformation of the scene might spring into being. It would be foolish, however, to disguise the gravity of the hour. It would be still more foolish to lose heart and courage, or to suppose that well-trained, well-equipped armies, numbering 3 or 4 millions of men, can be overcome in the space of a few weeks or even months by a swoop or raid of mechanized vehicles, however formidable. We may look with confidence to the stabilization of the front in France and to the general engagement of the masses, which will enable the qualities of the French and British soldiers to be matched squarely against those of their adversaries. For myself, I have invincible confidence in the French army and its leaders. Only a very small part of that splendid army has yet been heavily engaged. And only a very small part of France has yet been invaded. There is good evidence to show that practically the whole of the specialized and mechanized forces of the enemy have been already thrown into the battle, and we know that very heavy losses have been inflicted upon them. No officer or man, no brigade or division, which grapples at close quarters with the enemy wherever encountered, can fail to make a worthy contribution to the general result. The armies must cast away the idea of resisting attack behind concrete lines or natural obstacles, and must realize that mastery can only be regained by furious and unrelenting assault. And this spirit must not only animate the high command, but but must inspire every fighting man. In the air, often at serious odds, often at odds, hitherto thought overwhelming, we have been clawing down 3 or 4 to 1 of our enemies. And the relative balance of the British and German air forces is now considerably more favorable to us than at the beginning of the battle. In cutting down the German bombers, we are fighting our own battle, as well as that of France. My confidence in our ability to fight it out to the finish with the German Air Force has been strengthened by the fierce encounters which have taken place and are taking place. At the same time, our heavy bombers are striking nightly at the taproot of German mechanized power and have already inflicted serious damage upon the oil refineries on which the Nazi effort to dominate the world directed their pen. We must expect that as soon as stability is reached on the Western Front, the bulk of that hideous apparatus of aggression, which dashed Holland into ruin and slavery in a few days, will be turned upon us. I am sure I speak for all when I say we are ready to face it, to endure it, and to retaliate against it to any extent that the unwritten laws of war permit. There will be many men and many women in this island who, when the ordeal comes upon them, and some it will feel comfort and even a pride that they are sharing the perils of our labs at the front, soldiers, sailors, and airmen, God bless them, and are drawing away for them a part, at least, of the onslaught they have to bear. Is not this the appointed time for all to make the utmost exertions in their power? If the battle is to be won, we must provide our men with ever-increasing quantities of the weapons and ammunition they need. We must have, and have quickly, more aeroplanes, more tanks, more shells, more guns. There is imperious need for these vital munitions. They increase our strength against the powerfully armed enemy. They replace the wastage of the obstinate struggle, and the knowledge that wastage will speedily be replaced enables us to draw more readily upon our reserves and throw them in now that everything counts so much. Our task is not only to win the battle, but to win the war. After this battle in France abates its force, there will come the battle for our island. For all that Britain is and all that Britain means, that will be the struggle. In that supreme emergency, we shall not hesitate to take every step, even the most drastic, to call forth from our people the last ounce and the last inch of effort of which they are capable. The interests of property, the hours of labor, are nothing compared to the struggle for life and honor, for right and freedom, to which we have vowed ourselves. I have received from the chiefs of the French Republic, and in particular from its indomitable Prime Minister, Monsieur Reynaud, the most sacred pledges that whatever happens, they will fight to the end, be it bitter or be it glorious. Nay, if we fight to the end, it can only be glorious. Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Side by side, unaided except by their kith and kin in the great dominions and by the wide empires which rest beneath their shield, side by side, the British and French peoples have advanced to rescue not only Europe, but mankind from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny which has ever darkened and stained the pages of history. Behind them, behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall. Today is Trinity Sunday. Centuries ago, words were written to be a call and a spur to the faithful servants of truth and justice. Arm yourselves and be ye men of valor, and be in readiness for the conflict, for it is better for us to perish in battle than to look upon the outrage of our nation and our altars. As the will of God is in heaven, even so let him do.
Thank you. If there's one thing that we as a band want to deal with, it's the issues.
That's just one of the things.
Yeah. Like the future of the planet. The future of my children and my children's children. And
well, you know,
my children's children's children, you know.
Actually, Brett, when I think about your children and your children's children, I actually think your children are too young to be having children. And as far as your children's children's children, I think, you know, where does it stop? When the children are having children, you know, it's just, how small are they going to get?
Too small.
Too small.
Too small.
Exactly.
That's one of the issues.
It's just going to get into this ridiculous Russian doll situation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, have you met my kid? Have you met their little kids?
Yeah,
and it's just going to be... Well, in some ways, Brett, I think your children aren't going to be affected by a lot of things that affect other children because your children aren't real.
Okay.
Do you see the distinction between them?
Yeah, sure. But they still have issues. They don't get taken seriously, and they have to deal with all the imaginary stuff, like rogue unicorns, for example. You know?
Okay, sure. There's lots of stuff I haven't thought about, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
My wife and I weren't able to have children. That's why we chose to imagine them. The doctor suggested it, and it's actually been incredibly rewarding. Yeah.
Brett's wife is unable to have children because she's not a real woman.
She's an imaginary person. And the kids take after her in that sense. But she's very beautiful. She is a very beautiful woman.
She's a very beautiful woman.
Yeah.
She's a much better kind of woman than some of the women that I've imagined.
Yeah.
Nope. Good evening and welcome to Strategic Planning. I just realized that my introduction was slightly premature because the first selection I want to play for you is, in fact, covered by an advertisement. Tum-de-tum-tum-tum. Tum-de-tum-tum-tum. Okay, now.